Hello and welcome to the next episode of Lost in Criterion. I'm John Patrick Owatari-Dorgan, and with me, as always, is a man whose terrifying menagerie consists entirely of porch raccoons.
I am the Adam Glass, and it's all the porch raccoons who have ever lived in my porch, but also the one squirrel who's trying to eat the porch.
Right, well, so
every summer,
presumably,
choose more of my porch.
The squirrel will be the one that you turn into some sort of terrifying monstrosity first to be the leader of the raccoons, because it's the most destructive, the most clearly angry at the world.
The squirrel is definitely the sayer of the law.
I mean, well, the squirrel wasn't eating meat anyway, so that's fine. We've taken care of that law.
Right.
Is it what?
Yeah.
I think squirrels are perfectly capable of walking on two legs for some period of time.
Yeah,
I forget what the rest of the laws are. They're probably not important. It's probably just those two. Oh, just do not kill. Really, you were doing this whole animal into human thing on easy mode by picking a squirrel.
Pat, before we get into the movie this week, I do want to talk about our Patreon. It's patreon.com/lostincriterion. Over there for $1 a month, help keep us going, help us pay our server bills, and you get access to some bonus content. We do a non-Criterion film each month. Our supporters get to vote on what we're going to watch. And we just have a lot of fun.
We have a great time. It's like a lot of fun.
Most recently, as of this recording, we watched This Quiet Earth, drawing from that Criterion channel list of post-apocalyptic movies. And it was it's an insane movie. It's very subdued for most of it, and then
insane wrecking a truck full of dynamite into a satellite dish. You know, as subdued movies will do.
No, really fun. Go watch that movie, and then go support us on Patreon and listen to that episode. It was good times. You get access to to the bonus episodes, to the vote, and all the back catalog of bonus episodes for just $1. But for folks who can afford it, help keep us going a little more. We have a couple tiers above that. At $5, we thank those folks on air. And thank you so much to our current $5 supporters, Stephen Goldmeyer, Chris Otto, Andrew Jarrett, and Eric Coronado.
Yes, thank you.
Low above that, we do something pretty dang special. Pat makes a piece of art based on one of the movies we've watched recently. I get that printed up on a postcard with a little personalized thank you note to our $10 and above supporters. Also like to thank them on air, so thank you so much. To Jason Westhaver, Nina Bojnak, Patrick Yako, Tracy McGrath, and Adam Speakerman,
our $10 and
above supporters. If you want to check out those postcards without committing to that $10 Patreon mark, you can head over to redbubble.com, search for Lost in Criterion there. You can sort through all of Pat's art, all those postcards. Well, most of those postcards, if you have been challenged
except for the legally dubious
copyright
ones.
Yes, all except for the not actually the legally dubious,
the ones that have been,
the ones that,
as we point out many times, the ones that have been labeled legally dubious are the least legally dubious,
even though they're very much fair use. But anyway, a couple have been challenged, and Redbubble is not interested in ever standing up to copyright challenges. But the Redbubble isn't just a gallery of Pat's work. It is also a place to buy those as postcards, as greeting cards, as stickers, as magnets, and some as a few other things as well. Thank you to everybody who has purchased anything off of Redbubble. Thank you to everybody who supported us on Patreon, and thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you all.
Pat, this week we're watching a movie from a director we'll never see again, and a director who has nothing important about him. A director who literally, before becoming a film director, ran dog and pony shows.
Like, I to the point where, like, I forgot that there was a director. Like, we like, usually that's a thing I engage with. I didn't even think about it. Like, because, like, the cast seems to be everything there is to think about in this,
right. movie. Well, it also helps that this movie stars Charles Laughton, who was also a one-and-done film director, did Night of the Hunter.
Right.
And had such a terrible experience that he never directed again. But good to see him again. Charles Laughton didn't direct this movie. Earl C. Kenton did. And besides this, did almost nothing. All B movies. And this isn't really a B movie.
It's not. But like it's that, you know, we watched multiple sort of commentary things about it. It fits into that really weird. It is the reason B movies exist in many ways, right? Like not this one specifically, but like the how popular these sorts of horror movies became, and then continued to be in reshowings as they were shown to like consecutive generations in like drive-ins and stuff is the reason why so many B movies exist, I think, basically, right? Like the original Frankenstein fits into the same category and stuff, right?
Right. So Island of Lost Souls from 1932 is what we're talking about. It is an adaptation of the H.G. Wells novel, The Island of Dr. Moreau. It is one of, I think, ultimately three American film adaptations of that story. It is the one made while Wells was still alive.
So he could comment on
it. Wells is one of those, and he hated it.
Yep. Understandably, Wells, right? Like his objection to it is based on the fact that like what anybody like who has written a famous book objects to, which is like, well, you didn't make my book, you
right.
did something else, which like fair enough. That is a reasonable thing to say if you're the writer of the book. It is also reasonable to say that like that also doesn't matter.
You remember years and years ago when Picasso showed up in one of the Jean Cocteau films, mm-hmm. and you spent some time just bewildered that Picasso was alive in the 60s. That was just a compartmentalization.
But that's not the way we're taught history, right? Like as human beings, like we just don't. People are separated into the era in which they are like a dominant force, and they're not allowed to like cross.
Right. Yeah, my version of that happened
with
this
H.G.
week
Wells?
In that the idea that H.G. Wells was alive to comment on film adaptations of H.G. Wells was something that never occurred to me before.
Right, yeah. Like, I dealt with that one better than I did with Picasso. It still did do it to me a little bit. Yeah. I just recovered faster. Because it was like, okay, well, this kind of makes sense, right? Because,
right,
like, I could handle it better. Partially because I have a better grasp on, like, when H.G. Wells was alive than I do on when Picasso was alive, because in my mind, Picasso was like somehow like a million years ago. I don't know why. Like, I never had a good conceptual understanding of that. But yeah, no, it is still weird to think of. You are right, because it's like, wait, like that. It's also like, it really does, it does a number on you, because partially the sort of flow of science and things that we use to delineate time, major milestone events in history, is such that like a lot of that happens very quickly in a very short period of time that like seems to delineate the modern world from the past, when it's not really like a lot of things happen in a very short period of time rather than like over a slow progression. The other one, obviously, is that we always talk about is the fact that Abraham Lincoln and Karl Marx are contemporaries, which is a real mind fuck when you think about it. Makes sense, but it's a real mind twister. Like, but the idea that like, because bearing in mind that like H.G. Wells' book features vivisection as the primary method of blending two animals together, an idea that even by the time the movie is made is antiquated.
Right.
Which is not very much later, right? We're not talking about a mass amount of time. And then by the time, you know, you get into the, you know, and within another 20 or 30 years becomes, even what's in the movie becomes wildly antiquated in terms of, like, our understanding of how anything works.
Right.
What I like about movies like this and this sort of thing is that, like, I really admire, and this has nothing to do with what the movie is doing, the fact that like things like this, these kind of works, can really lay bare the idea that like at any given time in history, including this one right now, science is completely and utterly convinced that they've got it all worked out. But not really science, yeah. Popular science. Scientists,
right.
The actual practicing group of people, are fully aware of, like, I know only a fraction of what I would like to know, right? And even that could change tomorrow. Right. It's more like the popular conception of science that is constantly being sort of upended, in because people are like, well, we know everything. And then, you know, he refers in this movie to a unit of germplasm,
right,
as like
the
method. And I don't know if that's just totally, I mean, I know it's not real, but I don't know if that's like,
right,
was a thing that people thought was real in the 1930s.
The scientific aspect of this that I got caught up on is that it presupposes that man is the pinnacle of evolution and everything is evolving to be a man.
Yeah, that's an that is a really fascinating like supposition.
I would love a version of the Island of Dr. Moreau where the principal problem he keeps running into is that he keeps accidentally creating crabs.
Yeah, right? Or trees. Dendrification.
Or trees.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. For some reason, everything wants to either be every plant life wants to be a tree, and every animal life wants to be a crab for some reason.
Yeah. Crazy how that works. But yeah. That's obviously the science marches on. So one of our bonus features is a conversation between a horror genre guy.
Yeah.
Bob Burns. Makeup artist Rick Baker and John Landis.
Yeah, Rick Baker was the guy I'm actually actively familiar
with.
So.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The makeup artist Rick Baker. You definitely, because you have a joy of film makeup.
Yeah, I've been obsessed with effects since I was a little kid, and it's still a thing I can never let go of. Yeah. Even though I've never really interacted with it in a meaningful way.
Yeah. Yeah. Baker and Landis and Bob Burns have all worked together previously. Baker did effects for, say, American Werewolf in Paris, or in London, rather. Paris was a different movie. But I probably could have gone without hearing John Landis talk on anything Criterion related, but whatever.
Yeah, it was kind of almost bound to happen, right? But yeah.
Yeah, eventually. One thing that comes up there is... that Wells meant the original book to be an anti-vivisection pamphlet.
Right.
That's weird, because I thought, I mean, give and take, these don't necessarily go hand in hand. But for some reason, I thought Wells he thought poor people needed to be bred out of society.
I don't know. I don't know. I hardly know anything about H.G. Wells as a person.
Eugenicist. That's the word I'm looking for. I thought Wells was a eugenicist.
I mean, he could be both.
Yeah.
Like you could.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like I want you to consider for a moment, Adam, the fact that there exists in the world we live in right now, currently, a very large portion of people who will decry cruelty to animals, but will then also cheer on massive bombings of civilians in various locations on Earth. You know what I mean? Like, but will be like anti-animal cruelty activists while also cheering on genocide. You know what I mean? Like, it's these people exist. They've existed for a long time. They still exist. They will exist probably forever. I mean, there is a quote in the New York Review of Books. The only thing I found on the Wikipedia was a quote saying, although Wells was prophetically right and right-minded about some things, nowhere was he more disturbingly wrong than in his loathsome affinity for eugenics, is a quote from The Future Was His, which is presumably a book about H.G. Wells. It is. I think you are right about that. I think it is, well, it's the... I don't think that this book, this movie, or the book or this movie was actually meant to be an anti against the idea of like that sort of hierarchy of cultures that and races that you get sort of laid out in eugenics, right?
Yeah.
Although interestingly enough,
yeah,
one could easily read it that way because you could, you know, as they talked about in that one, I think the idea that is the movie about evolution, or is it about the obsession with evolution that develops during the colonial era? Which is a fair point to make, obviously, with H.G. Wells being who he was. It seems like it might just actually just be the former. But then again, we could choose to read it as the latter and ignore him. Like, that's an option that is available.
Yeah, no, to I just found the eugenics quote I was looking for from Wells. Wells believed it would be impossible for eugenics to work out if only the best people were selected to breed. And in fact, in order to really, really get the best of humanity, you'd have to start sterilizing the failures.
I mean, good to know he was essentially a Nazi. Good job.
I mean, considering like the socialist class points of so much of his other work, very disappointing. This is why I remembered it. Very disappointing to find out Wells was eugenicist in a lot of ways too. Anyway, apparently hated animal testing, so he's got that going.
so many facets. That's the thing, right? Is like I said, like as I mentioned earlier, you will encounter all over the world people who hold seemingly contradictory concepts about what is or is not worthy of their sort of attention and their scorn, right? I don't know. I mean, this would be, but there, then again, if one assumes that this story is not focused on the obsession, the Victorian obsession with evolution, but rather is actually focused on evolution as a concept and possibly the idea that there is a hierarchy of cultures, which was definitely a Victorian obsession.
Which leads
you to the creation of things like anthropology and stuff like that in their sort of nascent forms. You end up with an idea of this is a movie or this is a book and then therefore a movie about how it's impossible to elevate people from that the Victorian colonial project is wrong-headed because it is impossible to lift these unevolved races out of their their misery.
We have the Black Narcissus problem.
Yeah,
but though even worse. There's another bonus feature with film historian David J. Scull, horror film historian David J. Scull, who gets into a little bit about Wells' work being attuned to social Darwinism, and social Darwinism being the only exposure to Darwinian evolutionary ideas that the average person actually had. Yeah. Everybody's real on board with that aspect of things. And then ties it to, you know, continuing into the 20th century and tying it to popular films of this era and or early horror films, this Frankenstein, Dracula, etc., and movie monsters being an aspect of animalized humans.
Right.
You know, humans made into monster. Yeah. Yeah.
When you think about a thing that I find very fascinating, right, is that like much like we're possibly talking about with H.G. Wells here is like when all of those, what you constantly find yourself doing is modern audiences in the 30s, 40s, embracing totally radically different ideas about what those stories are about in order to make them say these things that like Frankenstein is 100% not about that. But they do because it fits, you know, as we see these stories keep getting reinvented in order to tell whatever the dominant narrative is. Like I've never seen the 1996 remake, but I can assume that it plays into a more modern narrative about what, you know, the sort of dominant cultural concepts.
As a quick aside, I have seen the 1996 remake, but I saw it in 1997.
Oh, so you were very young.
Yeah. The 96 version, me and my dad were home together for a weekend while the rest of my family was out. He remembered liking the book when he read it as a kid. So we rented the 1997 John Frankenheimer Island of Dr. Moreau. And it is the only movie I ever remember him turning off in the middle.
Right.
I think there is a love scene in it, and that would have been something he would have turned off, especially if he was watching it with me. But it wasn't that. It was just, it's the only movie I've ever experienced watching with my dad where it was so bad he couldn't watch it anymore. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was an era where, no, you never did that because, nobody did because you're, renting a movie or whatever was such a, all that was.
Oh, yeah.
You just powered through. That's just what you did.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Richard Stanley does one of the bonus features as well, and I'm pretty sure he's the screenwriter.
Well, he did write the screenplay, although it's somewhat unclear how much of that screenplay he wrote remains in this. But he's also to be the director.
Right. He was the original director, and there's a fascinating documentary about the creation of the 96 version, wherein and Stanley hints at this in his bonus bit, where after he was fired, he didn't leave and was just living in the jungle for 2 months.
He just took the payout that they gave him for they canceled the film, basically. I really want to watch this documentary because the whole thing is a bit confusing and hard to he's trying to tell it clearly. But it seems so fucked up and strange, strange decisions. They seem to have let him go, broken the contract with him because it's seemingly they're not going to make the movie anymore. And then lo and behold, they just get a new director, so they pay for a director twice. Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like they fired him. It doesn't seem like they fired him because they were dissatisfied with him as a director. It seems like the movie basically got canceled because of a hurricane and stuff. And then they're like, but we already sank so much money. It's very weird. Because even when he's describing it, he seems somewhat baffled.
The 90, it was a famously fraught production that ended in a not very good movie with some fantastic acting talent in it. David Lewis plays the shipwreck victim. Montgomery is Val Kilmer, and of course Moreau is.
I've only read a little bit of the synopsis of the documentary, but it seemingly at every turn just plagued by anything that could go wrong went wrong. Right, Val Kilmer was also served with divorce papers on set.
Yeah,
Brando's. Daughter had recently passed away.
A lot of issues going on
that seems really no wonder. Honestly, the studio probably should have just kept it canceled.
Yeah, Brando and Kilmer, as far as I'm aware, are both in their most them. Probably because of the family issues, honestly,
right?
Just burying themselves in their work, but. But whatever stereotypes you have about Brando, this is the movie
that creates those stereotypes, right?
There's always, there's what's it? Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
too,
but Apocalypse but, Now but yes. is still he's still a very dynamic person in many ways, despite it creating a lot of stereotypes. That's true, but The later day Brando stereotypes seem to be almost entirely derived from this movie.
But in any case, it's a movie you've never seen. I saw when I was 12.
Right.
And
I don't know that I will ever see this movie. I have no real desire to go out and seek it.
But the fact that Criterion gets Richard Stanley to talk about it as a bonus feature on this DVD is very interesting. Because Stanley is also, as a screenwriter, he's someone who seems to actually grasp the point
he makes,
of the story.
He, in many ways, despite the fact that we have some experts with regards to the horror genre and stuff, he seems to have the most cogent explanations of what the book is about. Like, and they compliment what other people say, but his is in many ways the most complete in terms of like, really digging into the sort of the contradictions inherent to the story, and like how he wanted to portray those things was not given the chance. But you know,
right. There is obviously a class element in our film version here, right? Moreau is the colonialist, very much so.
Right.
Right. And there's even, I think this comes up maybe in the Landis roundtable. But there is that bit with the drunken ship captain and the U.S. official where he's just very surreal. Yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, sir. No, sir. You wouldn't like that, would you? Which, in that conversation, they draw a parallel to the ship captain being treated by American officials the same way Moreau treats the Beastmen.
Right.
And, you know, whatever else might have been going on with Wells' work in the original, the Beastmen are obviously a metaphor for an oppressed underclass.
Right.
Period. Right. Now, the fact that they are beast turned into men instead of men made into beasts, like the...
Well, it sets the dynamic that we're talking about with colonialism, right? Not the actual dynamic, but the dynamic that colonialism tells itself, right? Like, it plays directly into that like conception of self that the colonial powers have, right?
Right. And here... And I've never read the book, so I don't know how the book ends necessarily, but I presume similarly. Here we see the hypocrisy of colonialism, that the Beastmen are made to follow laws that Moreau does not follow. And in that regard, a very interesting thing that comes up in the Criterion essay, which is written by Christine Smallwood. Smallwood offhandedly mentions a very fascinating aspect in that this is banned in a lot of countries.
Right.
But Australia is one of them where it's censored but not banned. And in Australia, the film received a rating of NEN. NEN was an Australian film rating that meant not to be exhibited before natives.
Right.
Aboriginals were forbidden from seeing this film. Presumably because the hypocrisy of colonialism inherent to this movie laid bare would... Or, of course, it was banned in Britain for just being unnatural. So it in any case, Australia was concerned one way or another about Aboriginals being inspired or encouraged to violence by this movie. Now that has its own racist presuppositions behind it too, but they knew what they knew what they did, and they didn't want anyone to see this movie. But yeah, just the fact that the NEN rating existed is fascinating. It took me, because the essay only refers to it as the rating of NEN. It took me so long to find what NEN meant, because it's not easily publicly available to figure that out. Well, unhelped by the current state of Google, certainly. Right. But yeah, so you know. And then Skull, in his bit, ties the popularity of these films and this adaptation to Jim Crow America and wrestling with men treated as beasts becoming men, ostensibly, as their former handlers try to keep that from happening. Because ultimately, you know, the ending of this movie is that the beasts... men realize that the power of the same law applies to them as applies to Moreau. Moreau has been insisting a different law should apply to them, but if Moreau can do it, they can do it, so they do it.
Right.
Right. And the scene of, you know, them in the lab tying him to the table and grabbing the implements, and we pan away while we hear Lawton screaming. Fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, no, like, and in many ways, that a lot of that plays into, like, one of the interviews, and I don't remember which one, talk about the idea that, like, well, American movies have a tendency to turn these kinds of stories into about sort of like, quote unquote, about democracy, right? Or about, like, uprisings and stuff like that. And I would argue that it's actually coming from the opposite direction. I think you mentioned this a little bit earlier. I was reading something, but like, whoever says that equates it to the idea of like about being democracy. I would argue that it actually goes the other direction. It is actually, I think, the sort of innate fear in white America of like the sort of tables being turned that you see a lot, where there's like, the harm that we have inflicted will be inflicted upon us, right? Like, that's the quote unquote sort of in the mindset of America throughout its history, that has always been like, in many ways, the sort of call to action among white people has been the idea that, like, well, they will do unto us what we have done unto them, like, guaranteed, right? And I think that's what these movies are actually, when they put that in there, that's what these are actually about. They're not about, like, the idea of, like, freedom. They're about the idea that, like, look what will happen as soon as you let go of the reins of, like, the thing you have built.
100%.
And the thing about it is in many ways, that's still what the book is about, right? Like, when you, like, I've never read the book, but I read the synopsis because I remember somebody mentioning that, like, the book ends much more tragically in some ways, because in the movie, we end with, like, everybody getting off the island. It's all sort of taken care of, right? Like,
yeah,
the island gets to go back to what it's supposed to be, and they get off, and all the people other than Moreau get off the island or whatever, right? Whereas in the book, right, like, that's not what happens. And, like, the island, sort of all the things that Moreau has made just sort of slowly revert back to, like, what they were. Pendick lives with them for a while and then eventually leaves, like, and then sort of ends up pursuing the same career that Moreau had in some ways. Like, and, like, the idea, in many ways, that leans more into the idea of this about being about eugenics in the book version, even more in some ways, because it's like, well, the movie has this as a feature, but it's less pronounced, the idea that it'll just, they, without the steady hand of the colonial master, they'll revert to beastliness.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's so much more sort of on the nose what this is about, like, even more, somehow more so than the movie. And bear in mind that the movie is present at a later stage of the same colonial process, right? Like, 1930s is still, we still to this day are in a later stage, an even later stage of that same colonial process. But like all the British Empire holdings and stuff, 1930, these are still going concerns. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the stories people are telling themselves about it are slightly different, but at the core are still basically the same. And so the movies like this just play into that further, right? And by 1930, you're talking about, in this movie being made by Americans. Well, America's got the same colonial projects going on, including within its own borders, right? Like, and this movie being about that colonial project in many ways, right?
Right.
But having the same conception of those people that book had, however many years prior. I mean, bear in mind, the movie is only what predates the book only predates the movie by less than 40 years. It's right, there's only like a 36 year gap or something. Yeah. It's not very long.
Right. Yeah, again, that's what one of the things I was thinking about when I was thinking about Wells still being alive to comment on it. It comes up in one of them. It might be in the Landis one that Moreau, you know, he's in the white suit, You know, he might as well just have a pith helmet, but he doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. That one does sort of engage with the idea. Like, a lot of the bonus materials do engage with the idea of this movie being, or this movie, as well as the book, being in conversation with the colonial projects of Empire at the time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting enough, Skull brings up that Lawton seems to be channeling Oscar Wilde and draws a correlation there to when the book was written, Wilde's trial was happening, and that Wells made allusion to Oscar Wilde's trial in talking about the inspiration for the book. And Wilde is called animalistic for his supposed crime of homosexuality. And Lawton himself is a deeply closeted man. Interesting enough, Lawton himself says that his portrayal was inspired by his dentist.
Who was doing colonialism on his teeth. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yes. Well, the thing about that, right, is that, like, I get where that would all come from. It's sort of like, in the end, it's fine, but it sort of comes off as more of just sort of an homage sort of thing more than anything because...
Right, right.
Well, I mean, when you're, you know, because, like, Oscar Wilde very specifically would not be the Moreau character in that story, right? Like... And like, depending on what H.G. Wells' perspective on it was, again, it's very easy to read what this movie says about things the book, but like the movie even more so, it's very easy to sort of choose the direction you want to read it in. Like, we kind of have enough evidence to know which direction we should read it in, but like, it's vague enough in a lot of ways that you could choose to read it from the other direction, right? You could choose to read it positively rather than negatively. But, you know, we like I said, we have enough evidence to know that that's probably not an accurate way to read it.
One interesting thing Christine Smallwood says in her essay, and presumably also written in 2011, the essay, she talks about it essentially being torture porn. And she's writing in an era where, like, actual torture porn is popular.
Right.
Like, when did the first Saw movie come out?
Yeah, well, 1990.
When did Hostel come out?
Wait, when did she say she was writing? I'm sorry.
This essay would have been written in 2011 for the release, right?
Well,
so
I guess so, right? Yeah, that makes sense.
Occasionally, the essays are drawn from somewhere else, right? From pre-existing work. But,
Yeah, I mean, 2011, yeah, Saul would I remember the first Saul coming out when I was still seeing movies in, like, the Cinemark in Mansfield.
Yeah.
Like, the one that you and I used to go to that they built out in Ontario, I should say.
Right.
Like, I remember seeing the first poster for that out there.
There's no indication that the Smallwood essay was not written for the Criterion release. But she says that she's not sure any torture picture is weirder or grosser than this movie.
I can sort of see that. Like, sorry, go ahead. I do have a thought on that.
Well, no, I think she might be saying that other monster movies of the era aren't weirder or grosser than this, because the pivot to torture film comes in the next clause actually. This is an early torture film crafted for an interwar Depression-era audience more than a little familiar with violence, lost limbs, powerlessness, and fear, she says. So again, you know, she ties it to as a culturally appropriate film. And that, you know, B-horror movies often are reflective of their culture even more so than mainstream films, right? But this is a mainstream film, you know.
I mean, this bridges that gap. I mean, the thing about it is, what I will say is that there's a couple sort of things it is definitely more it's more scare. It's definitely scarier in a lot of ways than movies of this era of this ilk are.
Yeah.
Because I think in some ways it is engaging with the dominant cultural forces more honestly. Like, it is more engaged with, like, what that the colonial project and things like that that we were talking about before are.
Yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily on purpose. I don't think that's a thing they're trying to go for, but, like, somehow in the sort of the process of escalation as the movie, seemingly, I think, as the movie's being made, they sort of touch a nerve slightly closer to the world than a lot of the other films of the time do. I don't know if they're necessarily doing that on purpose. I'm not sure about connecting it to, like, the element of the interwar period in the sense of, like, the horror of the war. Mainly because I think it's more talking about, I think that's a sort of an overread. I think it's probably giving the movie more credit than it truly deserves in that capacity. I will say that, like, the violence of it is, again, I think more akin to the ideas that drive that Wells is talking about when you're talking about the colonial project are still alive and well in 1930s America, especially in America. America has in many ways adopted that mantle as,
particularly
in the 30s, as, you know, the UK and stuff are somewhat struggling. Mind you, they'll keep that for another 20 years. But, like, as they're struggling to maintain that empire of that colonial empire, America's just expanding theirs. Like, they're just, it's just.
Right.
This is now their project.
And at this time, the American colonial project is particularly focused on the Pacific in many ways. Right. This is
absolutely, you
know, we're in the process of post World War One. America's decided, hey, maybe it would be great if we owned Hawaii, and have pushed for greater borders around Hawaii over the course of that first half of the century.
If you look at sort of the monster design here, they talk about it like, there's this sort of, like, leaning towards ape-like features, which is a sort of classic element of the sort of racism that's concentrated more at sort of, you know, at, it's generally used broadly in American racism to apply to, like, anything, any group that they consider, like, the lesser races, right?
Yeah.
It's that beastliness is, like, key to understanding, and I think for the movie of telling you who the movie is about, in air quotes, you know what I mean? Are these people that Moreau is trying to raise up? And, like, I don't think the movie's condemning him necessarily for the way he's doing it, although he is really intensely violent about it. It's more that, like, the thing he's doing is a fool's errand that will get him killed. You know what I mean? Like, the movie's more condemning the action rather than the methods that the action's being undertaken as, which is, again, I think fairly akin to what H.G. Wells is trying to say as well, right?
Right. Yeah. Like I said, that's the black narcissist problem.
Right.
This place is too weird for us. We should go home. But the movie's not necessarily making the this place is too weird for us argument. I think the movie does an interesting thing in that I could see there is a read here, obviously, that left to their own devices, they become violent. But it's really left to, as we've said in your democracy argument, left to full participation as equal players, we fear they will become violent.
Right. Well, and it's more or less the violence. I mean, that is the outcome here. It is they will turn our weapons against us, basically, right? Like, I mean, we get that literally at the end of the movie, right? Yeah. Like, Moreau's tools of violence are turned against him, right? Those are the tools that inflicted this hierarchy on them, and then now they're going to use them against you, they're better, or whatever, quote unquote.
Right. I'm reminded of two things then. Not Wells, but Hugo, who wrote, I see this attributed to his introduction to the first edition of Les Miserables, but I don't actually know that that's where it's sourced from. But he wrote, I think I've said this on the podcast before, quote, "If a soul is left in darkness, sins will be committed. The guilty one is not he who commits the sin, but he who causes the darkness." And that's a very, you know, class-oriented take on, you know, Hugo's there using the word sin, but what he means is you know, corruption and detestable behavior. It is not the fault of the poor that they steal. It is the fault of the person who makes food unaffordable, right? The argument being made is in particular regards to Les Miserables. But I'm also reminded of a document I'm pretty sure I talked about before, too, that a group of Quakers and Mennonites in 1688 in Germantown, Pennsylvania, issued a proclamation condemning slavery, but also arguing that by the golden rule of treating other people how you want to be treated, enslaved people have the right, and these are peace churches arguing this, enslaved people have the right to by the turn of the violence they have lived under, to violently take off their chains. And there, that is not an argument that is an inevitability that if these chains are loosened, they will become more bestial. That is an argument that we deserve it. That there are pressures.
And I think it is an argument that, like, you get down to a fundamental idea that, like, the oppressed have a fundamental right to oppose their oppression,
right,
with violence. Like,
right. And that's, you know, that.
And that's a little bit different than revenge, right? I don't think necessarily they're arguing for, like, post-freedom revenge. They're more arguing that, like, hey, whatever it takes, right?
Right, and that's what Brown is arguing for as well, John
Brown.
Right,
absolutely.
You know, it's not revenge. It's that we are not, by standing up to oppression, you are not introducing violence to the situation. Violence is already there. Violence is just the status quo. To use violence to overthrow that violence is a justifiable position under a right of self-defense. Now, as a Christian pacifist, I do not necessarily agree with a right to self-defense, but
right. But
I
you find yourself in a very different position than anybody who has been violently oppressed over the course of the last 400 years, right? Like,
right. One, I have the privilege to hold that ideology. Two, I cannot make an argument from pacifism from points of nonviolence to say other people should be nonviolent, because then my nonviolence just becomes another form of oppression.
Right. It's just now it is violence. Your opposition to their pursuit of freedom becomes a kind of violence anyway.
Is its own violence.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Violent. I mean, that's the thing, right? Is that, like, you know, and in reality, what we look at now is that, like, America as a project has decided to square that circle by creating the concept of terrorism as an objective evil rather than a thing that has resulted from causes, right? That, like this idea that, like, you know what I mean, and that's created a very fascinating environment in the sense that, like, well, we've got the one thing that is truly evil, which is terrorism. Like, you've that trumps all other forms of evil. And, like, in many ways, the modern American system has flipped that argument in the opposite direction, right? Has flipped it entirely into the inverse position, right? Which is that the state is justified in any violence necessary to prevent the people who are oppressed from freeing themselves, right? From fighting against their own oppression, right? Like, it is a fascinating sort of perfect polarization of that argument in the opposite direction, right? And has generally speaking mobilized the mass politics of the United States to that aim, right? Like, that is the one thing that, like, where, you know, you're told constantly, you and I especially have been told since we were teenagers, because frankly it didn't start there, but it definitely did kick into high gear there, is the idea that, like, any action is justified if it stops terrorism, bearing in mind that terrorism is a direct expression of that concept of freeing yourself by any means necessary, right?
Right.
It's fascinating because it's really creates a, it doesn't hold up to scrutiny, but the system's not designed to allow you to allow it to be scrutinized. So it's
interesting the way those ideas play out. Even like there's a bit at the end of this movie, where Moreau tells Oran to go kill the sea captain.
Right.
And Oran says, the law? And Moreau says, it's all right tonight. And even before things escalated from that, I wrote in my notes, the first purge. Because that's the plot of the purge movies, right?
Right,
the
right.
The law doesn't apply just for tonight. And of course, in the purge movies, those are... The abandonment of law for one night is its own oppressive force.
Right. Yeah, I've never seen the Purge movies, but I get the general philosophical, the sort of idea of it.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, I guess it must feed into the idea of, I've never seen them. I have only a very loose understanding, but like, I have to assume that it feeds into the idea that, again, without law, without oppressive systems, man will revert into animalistic behaviors.
Right, right, right.
There is no morality outside of law and outside of religion, right? Is a sort of...
Yeah. No one in the Purge movies is using the there's no laws to break into Sally Mae and delete everybody's...
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated by that idea because, like, I think I know exactly what crime everybody would actually commit. You know what I mean? Like, whenever I've been told the sort of basic, whenever I thought about the basic gist of the Purge, it's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I could tell you exactly what crime, if everybody was going to commit a crime, exactly what one it would be. I'm always fascinated, but again, I've never seen the Purge movies. I don't really understand them. I don't really know what they're actually about. So perhaps they are enlightened works of art. I don't know.
Well, I'm also, from there, we can take a little shimmy to our other bonus features, which are all about Devos.
Their
inspiration taken from this movie.
Like I understand why. Like, I mean, on a core level, I understand why this happened. But it's the most sort of absurd turn that Criterion's ever done to us.
Yeah.
It's like... It's a tangential... There's no way to not identify this as a strangely tangential, like, connection. Right.
The only thing that would have been more absurd, and I wish they had done it because there's inherent artistic classism to including Devo, but not including hip-hop trio House of Pain, who were also directly inspired by this movie. Now, I don't need the jump around music video on this DVD.
But I didn't need at least this someone either, mention technically. It. I mean, like, I was fine without it.
But
it's neat to know, but it feels like you could just have a mic tell you that, I guess. Like, you could just be like, you could have done with any one of them, basically.
Right. But what is interesting from the Devo bit is Mother's Bond, the other guy from Devo, I can't remember his name offhand right now. Talking about how what they saw in this movie that brought inspiration for Devo was the shadows of the Beastmen on the House of Pain and correlating that to the shadows of the workers leaving the rubber factories in Akron.
I mean, let's be very clear here. My interpretation of this is Devo is a very fundamentally extremely classist group.
I think that is a read. I think the other end of that is that they are art students trying to deal with the fact that they see people being dehumanized by the system.
Right. I mean, I think the problem is that like the thing we do hear them basically say multiple times in there is that, and this is fine. They at the time are very young men that do not have probably very well developed senses of like conceptions of culture and of not culture for sure, but of class and stuff like that. But like the idea that those people are their enemy and instead of their natural allies.
Oh no, I don't.
There's a couple. They make a couple statements that imply that they the workers from the factories are inherently violent in opposition to them. Like there are multiple references made in their interview to the idea that they are, and this is a very intense statement. Okay, and I don't mean it as intensely as, but class enemies. Like
I don't think my interpretations of what was said are that it was a material distinction, not an ideological one. That what I mean there is that Devo is a performing rock band that is going into bars and playing for these same people who they are drawing inspiration from, and those people, not out of a judgmental stance. This is not the music they want to hear when they go to drink.
Right. And that's true, although they do talk about the idea that it's going to turn violent. But what I mean is that like when I listen to them talk about the workers, and this is somewhat informed by the way that the movie, the documentary chooses to shoot this, they show the scene where Pendrick is being cornered by one of the beasts than... Where we see there's a different world where this is maybe mostly on the documentary, but it does lean to the interpretation that like the documentary gave me, rather than showing, for example, those failed experiments toiling away on the treadmill or something, which maybe is what Devo wants to talk about, and might be accurate to what Devo wants to say or what they want to say. It's just hard to say. The things they say are somewhat ambiguous, in my opinion. Right.
I think Devo at its start, at least, and perhaps it's even important to point out that like we get one of the first produced works of Devo here with their cover of Secret Agent Man. Well, their version of Secret Agent Man is not a cover.
Yeah, not Joko Homo. A little bit, really, but yeah.
They borrow the chorus, the refrain. But in any case, Devo at that time is... Devo will eventually make songs like Whip It, right? Songs that have commercial appeal, radio appeal. And maybe it's getting into a market where the art world catches up to them. Maybe it's not, but... But in any case, Joko Homo and their covers and their version of Secret Agent Man are purposefully off-putting art, right? And I say this as someone whose band is a purposefully off-putting band, right?
Right. Yes, I get the
Platypus
idea.
Tries to alienate
outsider
an audience,
art,
right?
And things like that. That's
yeah. So it's Joko Homo is itself drawing on a Christian fundamentalist tract, and they talk about that. So I think when they talk about the workers reminding them of the Beast Men, and they identify themselves with the Beast Men as well, Devo, this is the entire concept of Devo is that society, the current state of American society, is de-evolving people into bestial men, into bestial people, into beasts.
Right. Which is, which when you get down to it, when you get down to it is what I'm going to call somewhat rudimentary in its conceptions of like society.
Yes.
Like it is 22 year old thinking rather than like well thought out cultural critique. It just is. And that's fine because they're like 22 years old. There's nothing wrong with being a slightly dumb 22 year old. We've all been that person. Maybe I'm not being fair. I have been that person. I don't know that everybody has been that person. But my point is
certainly
just that, like,
have been.
Conceptually, the idea of that, like, what the state of American society is doing is devolving people rather than like alienating them is a problematic step, right? It is kind of identifying the problem. It's similar to, in many ways, it's a different direction of like what evangelicalism or something does, which is like identify the problem but then like not understand. Like,
well, I mean, understand
that
they are a satirical project as well.
Right, I understand that. But satire is,
but
you base your satire on the thing you want to critique. It is, again, a very youthful, very childish conception of the thing they're trying to satirize. And that's okay. Yeah. Again, there's nothing wrong with doing that when you're 22 years old. Okay? Like, there's just nothing.
I mean,
at its core, there's nothing wrong with that.
I don't think this really comes up a lot, certainly not in anything we've seen, but even in general histories of Devo, we are talking about people who were at Kent State in the early 70s.
Right. Well, and that's the whole other thing is that, like, you know, and that makes it even, like, kind of, because they're talking about, you know, the Kent State riots and stuff like that, and, like, it's fascinating because they suffer from what a lot of people at that time in that place could be considered a misunderstanding of what the situation's actually about, right? Like, you and I have talked about anti-war movements and the way they understand themselves relative to the actual project they're engaged in, right? Which is the moment the war ends, the war anti-war movements also end, which is a, like, yes, but it also very much makes it very clear what the project was actually about, which is a very sort of self-centered understanding of, like, we don't want to go to war, not we as a society should not be involved in war. I find it fascinating because they talk about the idea of, like, one of the things they're responding to, right, is Nixon's campaign in Cambodia. You kind of get it right there, right? You get this sort of burgeoning liberal sort of concept of what was the problem with the expansion into Cambodia, and what becomes the sort of dominant, in many ways, the dominant argument is this sort of like the idea of unchecked presidential power rather than the idea of like Cambodians as people.
Yeah.
Which becomes a problem, right? It becomes part of how you end up in the world we end up in now, which is, well, we've rectified those problems. We haven't actually, obviously, like, you know, presidents have more power than they ever have, right? But, like, we've rectified them in the system. The system now is back to humming along the way it's supposed to. So, therefore, it was never about the Cambodians. You know what I mean? And it was never about the Vietnamese. And that's a core problem to the way that entire anti-war movement functioned, was it was never about them. Now there might have been there were obviously people for whom that was true, it was about the Vietnamese, was about the Cambodians, but they were the minority, not the majority of that movement.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that it ultimately boils down to is that, like many projects complaining about the status quo, Devo's art takes more of an intellectual stance on it, perhaps out of the belief that the people they're actually talking about and inspired by, those workers leaving the rubber factories of Akron, aren't intellectual enough to understand what they're doing.
Right, yeah.
I don't know. You know, if vast swaths of completely illiterate or semi-illiterate people can effectively organize across the U.S. over the 20th century, I think Akron, Ohio, unionized factory workers could probably come to an understanding with Devo.
Right,
if Devo approached them.
Well, and also the thing you run into with this very, very young outsider art type of thing is, like, in many ways they choose to express those sort of ideas. It's also a rebellion against the cultural norms for art, right? Which is, like, not necessarily relevant to the rest of the conversation, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like the oppressive norms of art are not probably top of mind for people who are actually engaged in they can be, but they're not necessarily the most pressing issue, right? Like,
right.
It you get into like a cross purposes problem to a certain extent. It's like, well,
right. But when
what
one
percentage
can understand
of this is about
how they're
analogous? Right, absolutely. But like,
one can,
but then right. But you get into this thing is like, what is this art? You know, it's very clear. It's very easy to see, and you see this in lots of places where like the outsider art that gets made as a function of active work against various sort of systems of oppression and things like that. Some of it speaks to the resistance and stuff and becomes incorporated in it, and some of it is so tangential that it becomes a spur that has nothing to do with the resistance, and sort of as it sort of spins off on its own, right? And then, you know, that doesn't really necessarily get incorporated into it,
right. The only reason I bring up the Kent State Massacre is to sort of justify a Dada nature in Devo, that we're so far down postmodernism that none of what they're doing really has a point, because it's all like at the time they're Church of the Subgenius teenagers, right?
Right. Yeah.
And you know, the early Devo is what I would expect from people from there. Now, I respect it artistically, but
no, I find it artistically interesting. I find the video we watched artistically interesting. I'm not against it. I'm just saying that, like, at a core level, it speaks to college student art. It feels like that kind of art. It is for me artistically interesting, but like from a social commentary standpoint, mostly bankrupt in that capacity. It doesn't have anything in there for me in that way. And there's nothing wrong with that, because again, college students should feel free to make that kind of art as much as they want. In fact, the world is better for it. It's just sort of like, it's just interesting to have so much with them.
Yeah.
When like, their inspiration from the movie seems almost equally as sort of surface level as their inspiration from the factory workers in their town.
Right. And it's not even through the Devo we get the even more proliferarily inclusion of a 2-minute bit of Goulardi. And obviously,
like, I can almost justify that easier. Because like this guy showed these movies all the time is the reason why people saw it when it should have essentially died is a more fascinating thing to include and say, like, hey, this person, we have very little remaining evidence of this person who is vital to people knowing anything about these movies.
Right. So including Devo.
Right. Devo included. Yeah. But like, you know, the idea that these sort of and Goulardi being one of these, and there being many more of these around the country, of like people who would have seen these when they were younger, showing them to a new audience through the medium of TV, and that being largely lost. Like, that's not a thing that was recorded and kept, because TV stations didn't just make recordings of these live broadcasts. He was using like kinescope. He was like fucking like filming a projector of this thing, like, to show it to his audience. That is a fascinating bit of history to dig into, in many ways far more to me than the Devo stuff, because I find that like
I would appreciate it more on Goulardi.
Yeah, me too. I would have really liked somebody talking about him and other, because like this happened all over the United States. This was the way a certain kind of art was conveyed and passed on to another generation, that was facilitated by the medium of television. I find that I could watch an entire documentary on that. That would have been fine. Like, that, you could have just put that in there. Devo is sort of a tangential thing. That feels much more key to the idea of like, how do we even have copies of this around? And stuff like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. To a certain extent, some of this stuff depends on those people creating people who went on to be film, like, you know, people who restore film and keep film alive and stuff like that.
Maybe someday when we get to our first Paul Thomas Anderson movie, Punch Drunk Love,
we can talk about that. We'll get to talk about his dad.
We'll get to talk about his dad. There'll be another bonus feature dedicated to Guarni.
There's a serious possibility that that is true. Like, we're joking, but there's a real possibility that that is actually a true thing that will exist.
I'm hopeful.
I'm praying. I pray that that is true, because that would be so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. In any case, given the peripherality of Devo, again, could have talked to House of Pain. they also draw from
same level of you know.
right yeah, presumably I believe House of Pain is drawing directly from the novel, not necessarily this movie, right. Whereas Devo makes particular reference to this movie, but
which in its own self is a sort of like strange cultural transmission corruption, right? It's like this movie, which isn't all that faithful to the book, right? Like it's the sort of like secondhand transmission thing, right?
I love all of the bonus. It's just such a wide variety of bonus features.
It's a really weird one. Like, as I was sort of really going through it, I had to watch it tonight, like with my family. Like, I didn't watch the movie with my family. I watched that the other day. And I was like, well, the only time I had available was like after dinner, like hanging around. Kids are studying / playing, and I'm watching like a series of more and more baffling bonus features. Because I tried to watch them in what I considered a logical order, which is I started with the things that appeared to be talking heads talking about the movie.
Right.
And then I went from there. And that created a progression of just things getting weirder and weirder and less, like, comprehensible until, you know, you get to sort of, like, you know, I was like, well, I've got to watch the Devo video before I watch Devo talk about the Devo video. And, like, by the time you get done with the Devo video, which was the last thing Guarni was the last thing I watched because it was only 2 minutes long.
Yeah.
But I watched the Devo thing. I was like, this feels like it didn't need to be on this DVD.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the Devo video and the Guarni stuff are only there because Devo makes references to both. So they're for contextualization of Devo's relationship to the film. But Devo's relationship to the film is already so peripheral.
Yeah, it's surface level.
They don't need to be on here. But yeah. But yeah, in any case, we got to talk about Devo and Guarni. So thanks. I do love talking about Guarni.
I mean, that stuff is really neat. Like, all that stuff is neat.
Yeah. My grandfather worked for a time for a television station in North Canton that had its own Guarni ripoff. And he actually ran. It was more of a Saturday morning thing with them. But my grandfather actually also ran their weeknight, late night movies sometimes. Not in any sort of Guarni-esque persona. Just it's very silly to me to think about my grandfather doing that in that environment in the early 70s, because he's not that guy. But
I don't know if Guarni's the first. I don't know. This seems to have
he's
just been
the popularizer,
right? Like, it seems to have been a thing in the zeitgeist, like. Like the idea of a bunch of men who were in a position to show these sorts of things, who had watched these when they were children, or at least young. This, like, I don't know. It just seemed to be a thing in the air, right? Like, it's like we need to get, and then like maybe he's the spark that kicks it off. But like, again, you saw this like literally all over the United States. It was just a thing that was being done. And I find it fascinating because, like, when you look at, like, the Wikipedia for this, they talk about Criterion, this being, like, the most difficult restoration they've ever undertaken.
Oh, yeah,
one of the most difficult. It's, and, like, And you think about, like, how does that come to pass? And the answer to my mind in many ways is people like Gagliardi showing this to the people who are doing the restoration now.
Yeah, yeah.
Who bothered to keep copies and stuff floating around and demand that it be done.
Yeah. Since I had a physical copy of this, I get bits in the booklet that do not make it to the website. And there's notes on the transfer in the booklet. The original negative does not exist. Their primary sources, their principal sources for this, were a 35 millimeter master positive that had damage, UCLA's Film and Television Archives 35 millimeter nitrate positive, which also had defects, but contained dialogue in no other source, and a private collector's 16 millimeter screening print that they basically just used as the digital backbone. So they sewed this all together digitally.
Right.
Using the 35 millimeter prints as the primary visual, and then whenever they needed to fix something, pulling from the 16 millimeter. And, you know, watching the transfer, it is, particularly in the early parts, it is a bad transfer.
Yeah, I mean, it's rough. It's rough. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, it's one of those kind of films that, like, 10 years down the line, we're going to have a, like, there'll be a conversation going, because these kind of films now have created their own separate conversation of, like, do we clean this up? Like, is this...
Right.
Like, because bear in mind that any efforts to clean this up will start creating things rather than fixing things, right?
Right.
Anything beyond what has been done will create things that didn't necessarily exist in the original, right? Like, right now, what we have is the best possible version of what actually exists.
Right.
And going beyond this will require something else, which is the creation of essentially new material.
Yeah, part of the problem is, and Smallwood mentions this in her essay. Part of the problem is that a 1915 Supreme Court decision that films were not inherent speech, and therefore states had a right to censor films released within their state. And obviously, you know, that lasts for 50, 60 years or better, right? We get into the 70s before there's pushback against that idea. Well, not before there's pushback, but before there's movement.
Right, before the pushback actually accomplishes anything, yeah.
Right, yeah. But because of that, basically after the premiere, every state had a different version of this film.
Right.
With different states officials taking different bits out. And that's individual U.S. states, but also nations around the world where it was shipped out, because, you know, it's a Paramount release. It's getting wide distribution. So it's nothing like the notes on the The notes on the transfer does a little editorializing too. They use the phrase that the UCLA Film and Television Archive version contained dialogue unheard since the film's theatrical release. Is their phrasing? But yeah, you know, since it first came out, there was stuff that was immediately cut.
Right, and UCLA trying at the time to maintain an archive got a print immediately that, like, didn't necessarily get shown, so it didn't get cut, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's, there was... other Criterion restorations we've talked about, they eventually find, like, some pristine copy in a storage closet in old folks' home in Stockholm or something,
right? Yeah,
you know, or in the lost and found of the bus depot.
Right. I
or
mean, the problem is like, yeah, I mean, like, you know, we get those serendipitous things, but I think more often than not, it's stuff like this. And what will happen, like, I don't think, you know, barring that, like, there's just been, like, a lot of talk about, like, I've read a lot of talk recently about, like, using AI to clean these things up. And then I'm really, like, it makes my stomach turn because you're now creating things. You're no longer... It's like when they do those, like, when they do the recolorizing, like, the colorizations and stuff. It's like, well, now, but you're now just inventing things. These things are not, like, true to what was physically there. You're now creating things. You're now altering. Yeah, I mean, what we have is a degraded copy, but it's a degraded copy of the thing that was actually put to film.
You
know. Yeah, I don't know.
And there's still a lot of great visuals in this movie.
No, it works really well. It's just an issue of, like, the quality does hurt it a little bit in the sense that, like, especially in areas where, like, a better print with better contrast would show you what's going on easier, right? And I have to assume that the original version of the film did do that because you can see hints at it because when we hit a not very degraded part, it's very clear. Like, you can see what's going on. And then you hit, like, especially the night scenes where, like, well, this is not a very good copy. The black is not held up very well.
Yeah, there's a great bit in the bonus feature with the roundtable discussion with John Landis, where he's saying over the course of it, he seems to not realize how many extras are in the movie,
right?
And then later, he very definitively says there are 50 people here. After someone earlier had corrected him, basically, but
scenes don't read very well anymore, right? Because
the
original print would have had better contrast, would have, like, the little bits of human that you can see in the darkness would have been clearer. It's very degraded now.
Right. Yeah, I am very happy though that, you know, given the beauty of Wally Westmore's makeup work in this movie. I'm really happy that we get the scenes during the climax of the individual beast men stepping up to the camera.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Because we just get one clear insert, almost screen test-esque view of... just a dozen or so of them. Right?
Well, it seems like there's a desire, like, well, we did all this makeup work. We're going to fucking show you this makeup work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is fascinating when you consider that, like, a lot of the movie, as they talk about in that, depends on the idea that, like, well, even at the best of times, most of the makeup work is going to be obscured, right? Like, it's going to be far away. You can rely on the fact that, like, the people in the back... at most are wearing a wig and some slapdash shit on them because they're going to be so far out of frame and out of focus that they're just not important. Good enough, right? They look kind of hairy. They're kind of big. Good enough. But the ones who are going to be on screen, like, a lot, are given quite an elaborate treatment. Always admire classical effects work.
Right.
I find it really engrossing and engaging, and it was... neat to listen to people talk about it. I wish I could have done with more of it. But obviously there's very limited material about that out in the world. So this is the best we're going to get, right? But yeah.
Right. And even, like, the people who should know, who are most in a position to know, Skull or Rick Baker,
only have a passing understanding.
Are pretty clear.
Yeah.
Yeah, are pretty clear that they're speculating as they talk about.
I mean, they're speculating from a position of expertise. Like, okay, well, I know a lot about this topic, so I can say pretty definitively that this is what's happening. But it's still one magician watching another magician do their trick and saying this is how he's doing it. It's not the same thing as that magician telling you how they did it, right? And the material is just not out there. It doesn't exist. There's no memoirs of how it was made. There's no. And considering how sort of badly received this movie was, it's no surprise that, like, basically, seemingly a lot of the world just attempts to move on very quickly from it. Right?
Right, right.
Like,
right.
It gets banned nearly everywhere you try to send it. It's fucking just like, let's move on.
Given...
And this was not a Hollywood that was big on preservation or, like, keeping records anyway.
Do you think that this movie didn't catch on because people were reacting negatively to a perceived political message of anti-colonialism or whatever? Maybe because it was too close to Freaks and Freaks came out earlier this same year.
Right.
It ends very similarly to Freaks. I think someone points that out in one of the bonus features too. Or you know what? Because
like, I would say
the effects work.
The United States and the people of Europe in general are a lot touchier than people think they are when things hit a little too close to home.
Yeah,
when things feel a little too real, and like to a certain extent, there's a desire to like. You want these sort of circus-like displays, but you don't want them to feel too close to the reality that you actually live in, right? Like, this is not triumphant for Moreau. This is not like, it's not like, and it doesn't preach a message that is going to resonate with them in the way that something like Frankenstein does, right? The film versions of Frankenstein, right? Get into this idea of like mad scientists, get into this idea that is very popular, this sort of like slightly, this slight tendency towards anti-science, like anti-science and anti like progressiveness that exists within the American public at pretty much, especially the pre-war time, sort of flips on its head for a little bit in the 50s and 60s, but then sort of reasserts itself. This could be that. Like, but the ending I think is a little too close for comfort. Because it sort of starts to feel less like Moreau as an evil scientist doing evil science-y stuff, getting his just desserts, and more, as you said, something more akin to like the oppressed liberating themselves.
Yeah,
in a violent way. But I think it edges too close to that, and I think that makes people, and they could say it's because of the violence. They can say it's because it's grotesque, but we don't see anything like that. We hear some gross, like some scary screams. I would not argue like the our historians and stuff argue throughout the bonus materials that this is more scary and grotesque than other films of its era. I'm not actually convinced that that's true. If you go scene by scene,
well,
I think that
there is.
Go ahead.
There is one way in which it is that is maybe overt enough to cause a unique reaction, and that is the issue of rape in this movie.
Right. And I think like, but bearing in mind that again, we're getting into the too close to home thing. Because even when they talk about the Hays Code response to this, it's not the topic of rape. It is the topic of rape by these animal creatures that is overly grotesque. Again, that's a kind of too close to home feature. Because bear in mind that like we have seen plenty of movies that even exist in the Hays Code era that like that feature obviously non-consensual sex. Like, it's just because it's not conceived of in that way by the people who are making the decisions, right? Like, there is no such thing really in the minds of the people making those decisions as consensual or non-consensual sex in a lot of ways, right? What makes this rape is not the fact that it's non-consensual, it's the fact that it is a beastly creature doing it to a white woman.
Right, the rape's not the problem, it's the miscegenation.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And so, again, it's the too close to home phenomena. It's too real, right? Same reason why you get that code in Australia, right? It is. And I think that you could understand that that code is also a signifier to both sides, right? This is a signifier to the native, like it's sort of like, well, it's not for the native population. They might get ideas or something like that, right? But on the flip side, it tells the colonizers that, like, hey, this is about a thing that you're not interested in. This is about a thing that is too grotesque for you as well, right?
Yeah.
I would not be surprised to learn, like, we don't have the numbers, but I'd be shocked if it did basically any sales in Australia with that rating, because that would yeah. signify to the white audience in Australia also that, like, you're not supposed to watch this movie. This features things that you find grotesque. I mean, I'm just saying that, like, I think that is the deal, right? Like, Frankenstein is comfortable in its horror, right? It fits into a narrative that is acceptable within American society. So does Dracula. The Dracula film versions, again, these have nothing to do with the actual books, right? They are formatted to fit the viewing audience, right? And even then, like, yeah. we've talked about this with Dracula and stuff, things sneak in, right? Like, later on, you can go back and read these things and say, like, well, things get in under the radar all the time. But this one is just too, even though it's not, I don't think, necessarily trying to say the thing that it ends up saying. I don't think this is a purposeful attempt to make a cultural critique in that way. It just sort of accidentally makes a thing that's too real. It's horror yeah. movies to this day do that sometimes, right? Where they're like, oh, we just hit too close to home. This is not, nobody wants to hear the thing that this says, even if it's by accident. And I think that in many ways that is a special feature of a lot of genre work, that, like, that the non-genre work struggles a little bit more to, like, doesn't fall into that trap as often, right? Because you're dealing with quote-unquote reality, right? And so it's the reality as perceived by the creator. Whereas when you get into fantasy or horror or science fiction, you can accidentally wander into the world of, like, what's considered by society as perverse. It's much easier to do that, mm-hmm. to stumble into, even on accident, making the thing that makes everybody go, ooh, I don't like this. This is not good for me. Or you can do it on purpose. Like, plenty of artists also very purposely go out and try to make a thing that's, like, countercultural, right? But, like, it's also possible to just do it on accident.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you think about the way, like, Dracula, Frankenstein, because they make reference to Dracula, Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll, and Mr. Hyde, the film versions of those 30s film versions of those, all fit firmly into American narratives about human society, about the nature of man, right? Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde fits firmly into that conception of self, the film version does, for Americans and stuff like that. Like, you can turn that into a morality play that, like, fits their ideas very quickly and easily. Same with Dracula and Frankenstein, right?
Yeah. I was just, I was scanning through the screenwriters to see if there was anything that stood out as possible suggestion that something more is going on here.
Well, I mean, there's the development part, they talk about Paramount wanting to, and, like, this came up in some of the bonus materials about Paramount wanting to amp up the sort of sexual parts of the film and the sort of, like, and the horror parts, right? And, like, I think in many ways that desire is what sort of, like, shoots them in the foot, right? Because they are, that amping up takes them into dangerous territory that, had they made this a lower key version of this film, those, some of those things would have probably flown on the radar and been fine. I'm still not sure if it would have been entirely as popular as the others, because, again, the whole concept hits a little bit too close to home. But, oh my God, did you read the pre-production thing about, like, how they were trying to cast whoever will play Lota?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh my
yeah.
God,
no.
Lota. Oh, old Hollywood, you nightmare world. You.
I think I read somewhere. a claim that 60,000 women auditioned or joined the contest to win.
Yeah, I mean, the role Wikipedia the says Panther it. Woman. Like, I mean, I don't know what their source is. They have a source. It'd be interesting to find out how accurate that source is. Because, you know, sometimes Wikipedia can get a bit weird where it sort of references circularly with itself. There seems to be an article that somebody wrote.
The theatrical poster, by the way, which is also on Wikipedia, which posits the Panther Woman as some sort of siren. And that being what the movie The Island of Lost Souls is about. No allusion to it being a Dr. Moreau.
Yeah. That's a weird one. I don't know about that.
Right. Two, she's portrayed as topless on that. And three, most egregiously, twice it just says the Panther Woman. Kathleen Burke's name is not on that poster.
Right.
She is credited as the Panther Woman.
Yeah, that's not great for your
career. Or in the poster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Though she did have a career after this.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, like, being credited as the Panther Woman is really probably not the ideal way to kick off your career.
Well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a lot to add to this. I mean, I enjoyed what I saw. I did really like this.
Yeah, it's a fun movie.
It accomplished the goals I think they were trying to get across. It was a nice look into part of the sort of historic, like the kind of classic pre-war horror film that, like, you know, one that, like, I would have not seen otherwise, right? Because, you know, you see things like things like Frankenstein and stuff get around, you see them, you become very familiar with them through sort of the zeitgeist, but like something like this is a little bit harder to sort of just come across, right? And so I very much did enjoy it.
Indeed. Yeah, it's a fun movie, and it's one of the most esoteric collections of Criterion bonus features we've had in a while. And if nothing else, that itself is interesting and entertaining. Yeah, you know, there are other pre-war, or, well, maybe not pre-war, but 1950s horror that we've had in the collection where they just released it with no bonus materials whatsoever. And this probably gets released for a similar reason, that it's a movie an executive remembers liking as a kid more than
a
movie.
I'm not entirely sure, because there's reference to, like, in some of the materials, like on Wikipedia and stuff, that, like, this is a movie that a film of, like, horror people were sort of asking for. That no good prints existed. So similar to The Exec remembers it from their childhood, but more on a broader scale, right? A lot of people saw your Gagliardi and those sorts of things, show it when they were young, and probably enough of them saw it that they became. It's sort of a formative memory, right? Where you're like, I remember this movie. I want to see it again. And then Criterion being one of the few organizations that's in a position to do that kind of thing. My point just being that, like, yeah, there probably is to a certain extent an exec involved, obviously, because there always is. But I think also just generally speaking, it seems like there is some love for this film among the sorts of people who grew up watching, like, Saturday night horror features on TV and stuff, right? This is just one of those movies that they want to see. And, you know, the sort of movie that they all went out and said, oh, I should get that on DVD. I remember that when I was a kid. And then, like, hey, wait a minute. Why are there no copies of this? Why doesn't this exist? And you get down to the fact that, like, the only extant copies were sitting around those same TV stations where somebody like Gagliardi is screening it into a kinescope and, like, showing it on TV live, and that's, like, that's it. That's all that exists, right? And no, it's completely out of print. Nobody owns the rights to it. Like, it's just completely, like, floated. I mean, Paramount owns the rights to it, but it's completely, like, it's more about it. Like, it just doesn't exist, right? Like, the description of it is, like, no one has thought about this movie as a going financial concern in 40 years, right? Like, is Gilardi even paying, right? Like, you know, payments to like screen it, or is he just basically considering it like copyright free art because it's like not in publication, nobody's claiming rights on it, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's that would be an interesting thing to know. There's no way you're ever going to get that data. Although I guess some intrepid explorer could go try to find the books for like that TV station circa the years he was showing the film to, in the 70s, to see if like were payments paid to Paramount. Like, did that happen? It'd be neat to know, because like, was Paramount even like aware of the fact that they should be getting money for this?
Right.
I don't know, yeah. Because it seems like they did not even think about it as a thing.
So this week we've been talking about The Island of Lost Souls from 1932, directed by a guy whose name we will never think of again, Early C. Kenton. I said early that time. Earl C. Kenton.
Yeah, that's definitely Earl. But
Next week we'll be kicking off a box set of Krzysztof Kieślowski's film Three Colors, his trilogy. I think blue comes first, then white, then red. Thank you so much for listening to Lost in Criterion. I'm as always, Leah McGlass. With me, as always, John Patrick over Jari Dorgan. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Lost in Criterion with co-hosts The Adam Glass and John Patrick Owatari Dorgan. With the collapse of Twitter, who knows what social media we might end up at. How about Blue Sky? That sounds great. Check out the official podcast account at lostincriterion.bsky.social. Jonathan Hape does our music, and you can check out more of his work at jonathan-hape.com or on any music streaming service. And you probably should. He's pretty good. A big thanks to everyone who supports us on Patreon. You can join their ranks at patreon.com/lostincriterion. And hey, thank you for listening.